From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. After weeks of crafting their health care bill in secret, Senate Republicans are planning to unveil it tomorrow. And Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is already aiming to vote on it next week, before the July 4th recess. Sarah Cliff covers health policy for Vox. She joins us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
And do we know anything about what is in this secret bill yet?
We know some things, but like you said, Jeremy, it has been worked on largely in secret. You haven't seen any early drafts of the bill released yet, so a lot of it is still unknown. What we do expect is that it'll look pretty similar to the bill that the House worked on and passed last month, that it will likely cut the Medicaid program, end the expansion that the Affordable Care Act has, and really change how the tax credits work in the individual market. So we know some outlines, but a lot of the details still remain unknown to us.
Well, as we know, the House bill is said by the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, to leave 23 million people or so, 23, 24 million people without health insurance who have it now. Does that mean that the Senate bill would do the same thing?
So we don't know, but we'll probably know soon. One of the things that'll be a little bit different about this process is we're expecting to get a Congressional Budget Office score quite quickly. Some senators were even saying today the bill will come out Thursday. The CBO score might come out as soon as Friday or early next week. We don't know what the coverage loss is going to be like. The expectation is that you will see fewer people with insurance under the Senate bill, but it might not be quite as much as the numbers lost under the House bill.
Republicans have been criticized for the secrecy of the process here, and many of them have turned back around and said, well, this is what the Democrats did back in 2009 with the Affordable Care Act. Are they the same?
They're not. You know, I covered the 2009-2010 healthcare debate here in D.C., and I feel comfortable saying that the Republican bill has been much more secretive, particularly what we're staring down right now. This 1 week between having the bill made public and a vote is just so much faster than anything we saw with the Affordable Care Act, which was, you know, debated for over a year. There are more than 40 different hearings and committee sessions around it. It has been much faster and much more secretive than the process was around the Affordable Care Act.
Well, and this secrecy of the process is angering even some Republicans. Let's listen here to Arizona Senator John McCain.
We used to complain like hell when the Democrats ran the Affordable Care Act. Now they're doing the same thing.
We're doing the same thing. Will they be able to get the votes from Republicans to pass this bill?
That's a great question, and we don't know the answer to it. I don't even know if Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell knows the answer to it at this point. I think when the bill comes out tomorrow, we'll start seeing very quickly senators talking about the bill, where they stand on it, what they like, what they don't. It is still quite unknown whether this bill can get to the 50 votes it needs to move through the Senate by the end of next week. And, you know, I remember back in March when House Speaker Paul Ryan announced a vote on his health care bill, and then hours before had to cancel it because he didn't have enough support. And it's still not known to us whether we could see a similar situation play out in the Senate next week.
Well, one senator we've heard from Republican is Senator Ron Johnson, who has been saying some things that indicate that he's not likely to support this bill, or at least he's not there yet. Who are the senators to watch?
Yes, I would certainly watch Senator Johnson. I would also keep an eye on Senator Susan Collins from Maine, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, two of the more moderate senators who have voiced a lot of concerns about the cuts to the Medicaid program. And you also want to look at the conservatives, people like Senator Mike Lee from Utah or Rand Paul from Kentucky, who have raised some concerns that this bill keeps too much of Obamacare intact. You kind of have these factions on both ends of the party that'll be quite important to the debate.
Meanwhile, today is the deadline for insurers to file the plans they're going to offer on the federal marketplace for 2018. What are we seeing so far?
So we are seeing some insurance companies announcing that they are leaving the marketplaces. Anthem, for example, they had made this clear, and their filings today confirm that they're going to exit a number of marketplaces. But we are also seeing some insurance companies expand who, you know, are smaller insurance companies typically who see this as a business opportunity. There's a small startup called Oscar, for example, that is expanding into more states in 2018. So we're still waiting for those filings to come in throughout the day. But, you know, by the end of the day, we'll probably see more companies leaving than joining, but definitely a few who want to expand into the marketplaces.
Does what's going on with the marketplaces have any effect on what might happen in the Senate with the healthcare bill, do you think?
I think it definitely does. One of the things you've seen Republicans doing, including the White House, is using insurance company exits to make the case for their bill to say, look, Obamacare is in trouble. Right. We need to pass something. So I think the two really play off one another very closely.
That's Sarah Cliff, who covers health policy for Vox. Sarah, we'll be watching. I'm sure we'll be talking to you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, to Georgia now, where a $25 million barrage from Democrats was not enough to loosen the Republican grip on that state's 6th congressional district seat. Karen Handel beat her upstart Democratic opponent John Ossoff by 4 points yesterday in the most expensive House race in American history.
To the John Ossoff supporters, know that my commitments, they extend to every one of you as well. We may have some different beliefs, but we are part of one community. The community of the 6th District.
The special election was held to fill the seat left vacant by Tom Price, now President Trump's Secretary of Health and Human Services. Both parties were closely watching, thinking it was a barometer of the president's popularity. Republicans did win, and they won a separate race in South Carolina that got almost no attention. But maybe Democrats can cheer that that South Carolina race was unexpectedly even closer than the contest in Georgia. NPR's congressional reporter Susan Davis joins us now. Hi, Sue.
Hey, Robin.
And start with Georgia. You've been talking to Democrats today. We're hearing Democratic consultants like Jamal Simmons, say that the takeaway in Georgia is being anti-Trump is not enough.
You know, he has a point there. I've talked to a lot of Democrats this morning on Capitol Hill, and I would say broadly, they're pretty demoralized. This was an expensive loss for them. You know, they went 0-for-4 in the special elections for Republican-held seats so far this year. And I think the momentum going into Georgia, a lot of Democrats thought they were going to win. And to Jamal's point, the thing, one of the lessons, and I think there's many lessons to come out of Georgia, is that attacking Republicans or trying to link down ballot Republicans with Trump isn't always necessarily the best tactic, because Republican voters, more traditional Republican voters, which is who John Ossoff was trying to appeal to, still see their Republican local congressman is just different than the president. Trump has his own unique brand. So trying to connect the two in voters' minds might not be the best line of attack.
Well, President Trump took a victory lap this morning, tweeting that Democrats would do much better if they got together with the Republicans on health care, tax cuts, security issues. Spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders told Fox and Friends that Democrats failed last night because, again, they don't have a message.
They thought the elections last night were going to be a referendum on this president. And once again, he proved never underestimate him, and that the American people put him and other Republicans in place for a reason.
So a slightly different interpretation of, you know, running on an anti-Trump platform. But aren't Republicans a little bit worried? Georgia's 6 is about 9.5 percentage points more Republican than Democrat. Are they Republicans worried that Handel didn't win by those 9 points?
Well, absolutely. You know, there is warning signs in this for both parties. You know, a win is a win is a win. So the victory goes to Republicans. But one of the lessons we have seen in these special elections is that Democratic enthusiasm is way up. Democrats are showing up and turning out in these special elections in ways that their base voters don't normally do in a midterm election cycle. So there is an element there that Republicans should be cautious. I would also note that in 2006, leading up to those midterm elections, there was also a couple of special elections that were seen as sort of bellwethers. And Democrats lost those, too. And they still took over the House that year. So I've also spoken to Republicans who say, hey, we'll take it. This is a great victory. We've got a lot of momentum coming out of this. But you also can't take anything for granted 18 months out from an election.
Well, and that brings us to South Carolina. The race there to fill Budget Director Mick Mulvaney's seat got so much less attention. It was just assumed that the Republicans are going to win. But Republican Ralph Norman did beat the Democrat Archie Parnell, but by a little more than 2 points. And, you know, this is a reliably red district as well. And no one spent $25 million there. Nobody even paid any attention. What do you read into that?
Well, there's an argument, and this is being made by a lot of Democratic strategists, that that's a better way to try and win some of these races. That when you nationalize a race, you're more likely to get Republican voters to turn out in more traditional Republican districts. Running quieter campaigns, keeping them more local, personalizing the Democratic candidate was seen as maybe a smarter strategy. And in South Carolina, I think there's a lot of Democrats who think maybe Georgia should have gone more in that direction, trying to keep it small than trying to make it a referendum. And Republicans, particularly in Georgia, did make this a referendum. Democrats wanted to make it a bit about Trump, but Republicans made it about Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and equated electing John Ossoff with a vote to put her back in power. And for a lot of suburban traditional Republican voters, that's still a pretty animating argument that gets them to show up and vote against Democrats.
You know, in other words, the takeaway here might be that people are offended when they understand that people from outside, this is a congressional race, you know, so from outside their district might be spending money, might be better off not to spend it.
Yeah. And as you can see, you know, they spent $25 million and it didn't win them a district. Money matters, but money's not everything. And Georgia is certainly not a case study that can be easily replicated. Democrats want to try and put 50, 60, 70 districts in play, and you're not going to get $25 million for 70 districts.
NPR's congressional reporter Susan Davis, thank you.
You bet.
President Trump campaigned on a promise to pull out of large international trade deals and to focus on one-on-one agreements with other countries instead. But that has U.S. farmers worried. Last year, they sold $135 billion in goods overseas. They say pull out of those big trade deals and farmers here could lose valuable market share. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted explains.
Rancher Mike John in central Missouri is checking on a herd of 100 or so of his cattle as they graze on rye he's planted. The group approaches us thinking it's time for a grain feeding.
They look like my dog when I'm about to feed my dog. Got that look on their face like, okay, we're here.
2 years ago, John was looking forward to seeing the meat from these cattle shipped off to hungry eaters in Japan. He was ready for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, a massive trade deal among 12 countries, including the U.S. and Japan. It took 8 years of negotiations to get everyone to agree to lower tariffs. Some economists expected the pact to add $3 billion to the U.S. agriculture industry. But President Trump called the TPP a disaster and pulled the U.S. out.
We were very disappointed. The TPP was going to be a victory for us. It was going to open some markets and lower some tariffs, and those are the things that give you access.
Consumers in Japan have a growing taste for high-quality American beef. But today, the beef that John produces faces a staggering 38% tariff to get into Japan. The TPP would have slashed that number to 9%. Now that TPP is dead, John's eager to see the next move.
There is no question that every industry wants to grow and flourish, and if we're going to do that with 96% of the world's population outside the borders of this country, we have to trade. We have to export our product.
Even more unnerving is the recent news that Japan has pitched the idea of a mini-TPP without the U.S. Not everyone agrees free trade will benefit the U.S. economy, though, especially when it comes to saving jobs. The Trump administration wants to hammer out bilateral deals with TPP member countries, starting with Japan.
Strikes me that the trouble with doing bilateral agreements is there's a lot of countries out there, and so they're not going to get to everyone this year or even in this term.
Blake Hurst is the president of the Missouri Farm Bureau. Remember, 8 years to make the TPP. Knocking out 11 bilateral deals could take much longer. Hurst recently spent time in Washington lobbying alongside dozens of other heavy hitters in the ag industry.
There is concern in the agriculture community about the rhetoric that the new administration has used in our trade relations.
Bottom line, there's only so much beef Japanese shoppers want. And today at the supermarket, they're choosing between an American steak that's more expensive thanks to higher tariffs and an Australian steak that likely costs less.
That playing field's not very level when you think about the differences in tariffs depending on the country importing product to Japan.
Scott Brown is an agricultural economist at the University of Missouri, and he says it's not just about Mike John and his American-grown beef. So negotiations won't be easy or fast.
Those that care about agriculture in the United States and Japan are going to be different than those that might care about, let's say, cars or electronics. And all those deals work together.
The benefit of a big multi-country trade deal is that it can open up many markets. Say a beef industry hurt by competition in Canada can gain market share in another, like Japan. In a one-on-one deal, there's less to go around. So a deal directly with Japan could be difficult to negotiate, and farmers worry it won't have the same impact. Ultimately, American beef production is going up. Ranchers produced more than 25 billion pounds last year. Those steaks need to find international dinner plates so that the U.S. ranchers can make some money.
If we have to eat it here, it comes with lower prices to make consumers decide that they want more beef. So that growth in supplies needs a home, and frankly, that home needs to be outside the United States to keep prices higher.
Whether that beef finds a home in Japan could still be years away. In the meantime, farmers are going to have to settle for their current trade relationships, at least as long as those last. For Here and Now, I'm Christopher Husted.
And Chris's story comes to us from Harvest Public Media, a public radio reporting project that focuses on agriculture and food production issues. And staying with the land, I recently found out something about myself that I'm still trying to absorb. It was something of a shock, frankly, when James at the Garden Center told me, I am no longer a Zone 5B, I'm a Zone 6A. I'm talking about the hardiness zones, the Department of Agriculture's carefully determined designations of where certain vegetables, trees, fruits, flowers can survive and where they can't. And with climate change, the zones are changing as well. A map published by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, shows a northward drift of more temperate areas, areas where the average nighttime low temperatures are getting warmer. The data used is updated every decade. The last time was 2011. That's when the zone changes happened. But farmers say the higher temperatures since then mean people in many border regions can already grow plants rated as suitable for the zone immediately to their south. Here in New England, the zones run from 3B up in Maine down to 7A on parts of the Cape and Islands. North Carolina has lots of 6, 7s and 8 A's and B's. Yuma, Arizona is a 10. You get the idea. And they've been changing. So to see the impact, we decided to throw a dart and landed in Montana. Ari Laveau is a food writer there. We spotted his article, The Dramatic Changes in Our Planting Zones, in High Country News. Ari, when I think Montana, I do not think peaches, but you tell us people are growing them there.
Yeah, not just peaches, but huge peaches. Peaches that will just get your entire face wet. It's really something.
And where is this?
This is actually outside of Missoula in a town called Paradise, where the Blackfoot and the Clark Fork Rivers come together before they flow out into Idaho. So it's a region we call the Banana Belt. It's the warmest spot in Montana. And those warmer zones have been creeping up the river from Idaho, from the west coast, and they've invaded Montana, essentially, right there.
And would you have you had a zone change there?
Yes, down by Paradise, where the peaches are grown, they have recently been upgraded from a 5B to a 6A, just like you.
Yep, so they felt that same sort of shift in the earth, big change. But you say in your food writing that you are seeing things that are grown in Montana you'd never seen before. Like what?
Yeah, it's amazing. I recently purchased ginger, Montana-grown artichokes, and also things a little more subtle, like a lot more peppers, because you don't have to grow them in a greenhouse anymore. So everyone has just tons of peppers. And out on the plains, farmers are cutting alfalfa 3 times when they used to cut it 2 times.
Yeah. Pasta makers looking north, you say, in search of the next hot spot for the best durum wheat. Even wine grape growers?
That's right. Yeah. And both pasta makers and winemakers are very finicky about their products, so it really needs to be just in the sweet spot, especially the wheat. So they've been planning their northward migration.
But there are some problems that come with this. We know that climate change isn't just about the earth getting warmer. It's about extremes in weather. So we see areas that may be getting warmer but then have spikes of frost at night, killing frost. So is there concern about that in Montana, that you start planting things, but then you might have these cold extremes as well?
Yeah, like, for example, the peaches and other fruits, too, like apricots, plums, apples, nectarines, all of which grow in Montana. What you worry about is a warm February or March, which can trigger an early bloom, and then suddenly we revert back to normal and have a hard frost and all the flowers die and the farmer gets an unpaid vacation.
Or tries to, use some tricks to warm things up?
Yeah, if it's just a few degrees, there are some things they can do to try and, you know, survive the night. Down in Paradise, where the peaches are grown, they've got a system of fans called a cold air drain, which sucks the cold away during the overnight low period and allows warm air to come in. And with technology like that, you can actually buy a few degrees. You can also spritz it with water, which is a little riskier, but just coating the plants and buds with water will require more energy out of the environment in order to freeze them.
Bimo, what do you have? What have you planted?
Inspired by Tom McCannett, the peach grower who took a chance 15 years ago on a warming climate, I've also some much smaller chances on a Chicago fig tree, which is actually rated zone 5, believe it or not, and a pomegranate, a Russian pomegranate, which is rated zone 6. And we have not actually officially made the jump to zone 6 in Missoula, but it seems like a matter of when and not if. So I'm just going to keep that Russian pomegranate alive as long as I can and see what happens.
Taking a big leap there.
Ari.
That's Ari Laveau, Missoula, Montana-based food writer. His piece, The Dramatic Changes in Our Planting Zones, he wrote for the High Country News. Ari, thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ziprecruiter.com/here.
There are questions today about what's next for the world's largest ride-hailing company, Uber, after news that CEO Travis Kalanick is resigning. In a statement, Kalanick said he was stepping aside so that Uber can go back to building rather than be distracted with another fight. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So we've been talking about Travis Kalanick. We've been talking about Uber and the controversies and sexual harassment complaints and how those have been handled, the treatment and pay of Uber drivers. What was the final straw here?
Well, I guess it's money talks. Five big investors, including big venture firms like Benchmark and mutual fund giant Fidelity, they came together and they own about, let's say, a quarter of the stock, about 40% of the voting power. And they sent a letter to Kalanick yesterday afternoon. They demanded that he resign immediately. They also asked for improved oversight of the company's board by filling two of the three empty board seats with what they're calling, quote, truly independent directors. Now, again, Kalanick probably had the voting power to stay, but that pressure was really too much. And I should also note that the decision was really applauded by a lot of folks, but some are wondering whether the board itself might see some replacements because it's seen as complicit in Kalanick's behavior over the past.
Well, do we have any idea who might be replacing Kalanick as CEO?
What a horse race this is going to be. By the way, I should note that Uber has fired more than 20 employees, including Kalanick and his closest confidant, Emil Michael. He was forced to resign last week. So we don't have a CEO. We don't have a CFO. We don't have a chief operating officer, chief marketing officer, a head of engineering. So a lot of spots to fill. But for the CEO slate, we're talking about former Disney chief operating officer Tom Staggs, CVS's Helena Foulkes. And you're not going to believe this, but New York Post reporting, maybe the board will be approaching Facebook chief operating officer Sheryl Sandberg.
Wow. So she's in the mix there as a potential CEO for Uber. The other Uber news that came out this week is that they're going to allow passengers to tip the drivers for the first time, which is something that Lyft does, but Uber hasn't done.
Yeah, this is interesting because the company unveiled this new campaign just yesterday, by the way. It was called 180 Days of Change. And step one in that change is the company is now making an in-app tipping option available for drivers. It rolled it out in Seattle, Minneapolis, and Houston. It's going to expand to all U.S. cities. As you said, this has actually been done by Lyft. The company had resisted it, but now says the changes were long overdue.
So what is the big picture next step for Uber now that they've finally gotten past this issue of Travis Kalanick and his management?
I think this is actually a bigger question, and that is that, you know, the company's worth probably about $70 billion based on its last capital raising efforts. It has spent very heavily to expand It's actually been losing money in the process, about $2.8 billion last year, another $700 million or so in the first quarter of this year. So now a lot of people are saying, hey, maybe Uber's going to have to raise more money. I guess what's really imperative here is whoever takes over, whatever team comes in place, they're going to have to shift the culture and navigate some really big lawsuits. There's one that Google that Uber is fighting with Google parent right. Alphabet. So all of this coming together, it's an uncertain future for the ride-sharing company.
Well, and as it's been pointed out to us, you're right. They've been losing money as they've expanded. But if they stopped expanding today, they would be making money today. So
that's right. There
are some good things in that company. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always.
Take care.
For the past 9 months, Iraqi troops, with the help of the United States, have been trying to take back the city of Mosul, Iraq, from ISIS. It's the last major stronghold for ISIS in Iraq. It's such a dangerous fight that we rarely get a glimpse of it. But the New York Times takes us inside the fight in a new report and video that follows Iraqi Major Sajjad al-Hur as he leads his Iraqi troops in the house-to-house fighting in Mosul. Joining us now is New York Times reporter Ben C. Solomon, who produced the report. Ben, welcome.
Thank you.
And first of all, just tell us more about Major Sajjad. Who is he?
So Major Sajjad is a 33-year-old military major. He has been fighting his entire life. He graduated high school and the next day signed up to join the military academy. His father was a soldier in the Iran-Iraq war, so he grew up understanding the world of war through his father and through this kind of constant state of fighting in Iraq. He's got 8 kids. He's got 2 different wives, which is legal in Iraq. And he's been shot 5 times. He's a person that's really experienced in the ways of war and really kind of sees the world through that lens.
And how long has he been working on the fight to retake Mosul from ISIS?
He was there since the beginning. I mean, as soon as the operation started in October 2016, he was one of the first people in the crew to kind of go in. They split his divisions into different battalions and into different places to fight. But, you know, he's a really experienced and high-ranking major in that division. And I think they really value him not only as a soldier, but as a big leader inside the company.
Well, you film him going home to see his family near Baghdad, and he's sitting with one of his kids, and he says, "My family in Mosul needs me more than my family here." You see him flipping through pictures of his men on his cell phone. What drives him to want to be in this fight as much as he is?
You know, I think that when you look through the history of Iraq and when you look through the past 40 years, the most constant thing that has been happening is war and is fighting. And if you take someone like Major Sajjad and you put him in that context in this world where the war is kind of such a large part of their lives, you know, in a way, it's a lot easier to make sense of the world through that context. I think that Sajjad, you know, when you have a family, you have mortgages, you have bills, you have things you have to do, you have to take care of your kids. In war, there's only one thing you need to do, which is fight and 2 things and survive. And I think that for a man like Sajjad, who's had so much success and so much of his life is kind of defined by war, I think sometimes he tends to kind of see that as his main calling.
What about more broadly? We've heard for years that Iraqi troops haven't had that feeling that they have a stake in the future of Iraq, or that it's been hard to convince them that what they're fighting for is something worth fighting for. It sounds from your reporting like maybe that's not as much of a problem anymore, that people do feel that they have a stake in the future.
It goes both ways. I mean, Sajjad is truly a patriot. I think he really cares about Iraq and he really wants to see peace and he really wants to see the country kind of get better. But at the same time, I think that, you know, a lot of the people in the country for the past years have seen nothing but kind of conflict and corruption and confusion go on inside of their government and inside of their country, that there isn't much hope and there is a lot of confusion about what these battles mean and what happens next. Sajjad, he's more of an outlier. I think he's somebody that's really positive. He's really excited, but he's also someone that is, you know, if you ask him frankly, well, what happens next, I think he'd be very candid that he doesn't know. And I think he'd probably be as negative and kind of questioning as the next person.
And when he goes back to the war after being with his family in Baghdad, there's a terrible incident involving his men. Can you tell us about what happened?
So on a routine night patrol, the men were out in Mosul, and it was a part of his unit. It was a group of the men, about 15 in total. And as they were walking, when they didn't have really the proper equipment, they didn't have the night vision goggles that they probably needed, as they were walking and as they were doing this patrol, they set off a tripwire that was hooked up to an IED and set it off, and instantly 10 of them were killed. And I think this is something that weighed really heavily on Sajjad. But at the same time, it's something that happens almost regularly in this war. So many Iraqi troops are being killed out there, and so many are being maimed by all these weapons. And the numbers aren't really clear because the Iraqi government keeps them to themselves. They don't want a lot of the world to know how hard this is and how many people are dying doing this job.
How long do people think the fight to retake Mosul is going to take at this point? It's already gone on for months and months.
Every time you talk to military officials, they always say, yeah, you know, like the next month or two, you know, it's kind of the constant. Oh, yeah, definitely next month. Oh, for sure next month. It's hard to say, really. I mean, the reality is that over the past 2 or 3 months since I've been there, the progression has been incredibly slow. They are just kind of creeping through these neighborhoods, really taking, if at most, like, you know, yards a day. I mean, really, at times, they're barely kind of progressing. It's really hard to say what happens next. Now is they're going into fight in the old city, which is the densest part of the city and really the most confusing way to kind of move around. I think this is – everyone has been expecting this to be the hardest part. And now that they're finally there, it's hard to say just how they're going to do it and how hard it is.
And they're having to go into every single house?
Basically, I mean, it's just winding streets and old kind of marketplaces. They really, to be safe, you know, ISIS has put in all these tunnel networks and places to hide and places to kind of like get around expecting this fight and kind of getting ready for it. So if they're trying to be safe and they're trying to do it right, they really do need to go kind of house by house, bit by bit, and clear as much as they can.
But what happens once they do? I mean, it seems like it took the U.S. less time to take Baghdad from Saddam Hussein. But then after the fact, all kinds of problems emerged.
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. Last year in 2016, I was in Fallujah as they took that city. That was a much smaller city, much smaller population, much kind of simpler fight. Took about 30 to 40 days in total to kind of reclaim it in total. And now, a year later, almost exactly a year later, there's already new complications coming up, a new kind of insurgencies. And some might even say that ISIS is starting to see an opening and a return there. So, you know, the question of what happens next is a really hard one. And I think for a lot of the soldiers like Sajjad and a lot of the government officials above him, nobody really knows, and it's hard to think that this could just kind of be a cycle that continues.
What kind of task is ahead when it comes to rebuilding Mosul?
I mean, in the east part of the city, so my first – I was there for 6 weeks in February and March. So the east part of the city, which they took pretty quickly, was not badly damaged. It was impressive, actually, to see how efficiently the bombings went, how the fighting was kind of compact. It was impressive for the different combat zones that I've seen in my life. It was very impressive to see how well together it stayed. The West, on the other hand, in the weeks that I was there, which they are still fighting in now, is completely destroyed. It is in total rubble. So much of the infrastructure, so much of the city is destroyed. Really, it's been such a brutal fight and such a really complicated way to take it back. It's hard to say what rebuilding it looks like. It's hard to say who's going to do it and how they're going to kind of find the ways to kind of prop it back up.
Have the Iraqi troops who are fighting for Mosul seen any change between the Obama administration and the Trump administration in terms of support from the United States?
You know, I was with the grunts. The story that I wanted to focus on was the absolute grunts, the guys that stay away from that information. But, you know, the things that do trickle down and the policies that do get to them were stuff like the travel ban. And when they heard about that, I was in the country and, you know, they were deeply offended. They were really affected. They said, you know, this is a country that some of the interpreters and some of the people that fought beside the Americans, and Sajjad was one of them, they would say, you know, this is these are people we thought we trusted. We thought we helped them. We thought that they were helping us. And we thought that we fought hand in hand with these guys. So for the Americans to turn around and say that they're not welcome is a total slap to the face.
What's happened to Major Sajjad now?
Sajjad is he's still at the front lines. He is still at fighting. I think he's a part of the push to hold the old to hold ground outside of the old city. I think he's very eager to be a part of the fight to take back the old city. But for now, it sounds like he's on the back end, kind of taking control and holding the ground that they already have.
That's New York Times reporter Ben C. Solomon, and we'll have a link to his report from Mosul at hereandnow.org. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Remember when Harvard took back the acceptances of at least 10 students after discovering offensive memes they'd written in a Facebook group? It's a cautionary tale for young people that schools, future employers, future in-laws are checking your online life. But the story also was the first some people had heard of this college craze of public Facebook pages with university-themed jokes, memes that spread like viruses. UC Berkeley's Memes for Edgy Teens is the largest with almost 100,000 members. And now there are pages at Duke, MIT, every school in the Ivy League. So let's check in with Yale. This past fall, sophomore Charles Commodore and a friend founded the page Yale Memes for Special Snowflake Teens. And Charles, you tell us after Donald Trump was elected, some students were upset. One professor even made an exam optional. So Fox came up with this name for you fragile students?
Fox News wrote an article calling students from Yale special snowflakes.
How many people do you have on the Yale Memes for Special Snowflake Teens?
Right now it's 17,525.
Wow. How many people at Yale?
I think 11 or 12,000.
So more than are at Yale. So what are some of the things that are being talked about?
So right now this is a particularly funny one. There's a humanities program at Yale that you can take as a freshman that's very similar to Columbia's core curriculum called Directed Studies, and a lot of people call it DS. And there's a stereotype that people that are in DS are so proud of it because it's so rigorous that before they say anything about themselves, when they introduce themselves to other people, they'll say, did you know I'm in DS? So right now there's someone who posted a video clip of, I think it's from House of Cards, but I'm not sure, of someone carving the letters DS into a desk, which I think is unrelated to Directed Studies, but then someone captioned it, when you're the president's chief of staff, but still need people to know about your freshman year humanities program. And it's very popular and much funnier in context. It got almost 700 likes.
Well, I was just about to say, some of this probably is a little in-house. You know, you have to kind of,
yeah.
Right? Which is the purpose, I guess. You kind of have to know what the joke is.
Exactly.
Well, do you worry that it feels like any social media gathering can turn ugly pretty fast? And if it's, you know, if it's your Twitter feed, you can just ignore somebody. But if it's a community that's formed on a school page, do you worry that it will quickly turn attacking or worse? I mean, I know you have, how do you monitor it?
I'm looking right now. We have about 11 moderators who all of our sole purpose is to find content that is offensive, that we say, this cannot stay, this is going to turn ugly, and we get rid of it. And we've been pretty successful so far in handling what one might call, you know, offensive content. We've had a few issues where we've had to question, should we censor this or should we not censor this? But as a whole, we've been pretty good at managing.
Well, that takes a lot of work. I mean, I understand that freshmen are the most involved because they have the most time. They haven't gotten into writing, you know, doing their hardest work yet. That's a lot of work to monitor that.
Actually, when you have as many people as we do working on it, it's the kind of thing where everyone does a little bit and it's really not that huge of a time commitment.
Was the Harvard story a cautionary tale? Again, the 10 acceptances rescinded from the school after a private breakaway chat group, meme group?
We haven't. I know on the Yale Memes page, we've had a few very tasteless people post some very tasteless pieces of content, and we've immediately removed them, like not even a question, immediately. With that being said, yeah, it was kind of like, you know, you have to remind yourself, you have to be incredibly careful what you do on the internet, because everything does have repercussions. And everything's a lot less private than one thinks it is.
Of course. Well, and you recently posted that companies had approached you asking to advertise on your site, and you've decided to go ahead with that. This is a business now. There's responsibility. People wondering, well, what happens with the money? I mean, is it feeling yet like maybe it's too much?
At first, when we were approached, they approached my co-founder. They sent him a Facebook message saying, a company did, saying we'd like to advertise for this much money for you to make a post. And initially, we were very opposed to it. Columbia had gone through with it, and I believe so as UC Berkeley. And they were criticized very heavily for it. And what made us change our minds is that we saw that the potential that the money could have. We don't plan on using any of the money for our personal profits, and instead want to use that money to actually start a guest speaker series sponsored by the Yale meme page and these advertisements. So it is a lot more responsibility, and honestly might even be the kind of thing that I include on a resume. And I think more than overwhelming, it's just kind of, I smile whenever I think of it. It's just funny to me.
Wow. I mean, that is something that this little idea of just sending memes around might turn into people actually speaking for longer periods of time than a meme usually is. That's Charles Commenter, a rising sophomore at Yale. He and his friend started the page Yale Memes for Special Snowflake Teens. Charles, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.